Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point, and this is Chet Baker, stretching notes and bending time with My Funny Valentine in the 1950s. The music, it produces a mood. Do you feel it? Somehow this recording of Baker breathing into his trumpet, it makes some pressure waves, which is sound that enters your ear and then produces a cascade of electrochemical reactions in your brain that then make you feel. So how does that happen? Well, who better to answer that question than a neuroscientist who's also an opera singer? This hour on Point, the mysteries of music and the brain. And you can join us. Please do. Does music change how you feel, how you think, how you experience the world? Has it helped you through difficult emotional or even medical issues? What's your question about what's going on in our brains when we listen to our favorite songs? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining us today from San Francisco is Indre Viscontis, author of the new book, How Music Can Make You Better. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. And Indre is a professor of sciences and humanities at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. She's also adjunct professor of psychology at the University of San Francisco. And if that weren't enough, she is also creative director of Pasadena Opera and director of the chamber music group Vocalective. She also hosts two podcasts, Cadence and Inquiring Minds. Indre, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much, Meghna.
So we picked My Funny Valentine to start this hour because you mention it in the book as a piece of music that shows us how music can change our perception of time itself. How does Chet Baker do that?
Yeah, well, we all know where the beat should be because you have this kind of, you know, slight bass going, and we all know what the tune should sound like. And here's Chet surprising us at every moment. He's not putting the downbeat where it should be, and, you know, even the pulses in a particular measure are you know, moving here or there, but he always catches up. So it's not too jarring. We know where he's going, and we're surprised. And so that's essentially how it works. You know, our brains are predicting machines. That's what we like to do. We like to try to figure out what's going to happen next, because that's very adaptive. And music shows us how when we know where something should go, and yet we're surprised, that's really pleasurable.
Okay, so our brains are predicting machines. And does great music then sort of both satisfy and defy those predictions at the same time? I mean, how does it test our capacity to think we know what's coming next?
Yeah, exactly. And I want to just first take issue about, you know, using the term great music.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
Because what's great for you might not be great for me. And the reason it might not be great for me is maybe because my brain doesn't know where to look for the pattern. So, you know, in order to enjoy music, we generally have to have some kind of idea of the structure of the music. And that's why we prefer a genre with which we're really familiar. And some music, you know, is more immediately accessible because the patterns are more obvious. And, you know, they're more repetitive, sooner, etc. And so we can enjoy it on a first listen, but maybe that means that on the 10th listen, we're a little bored. So what may be great music for me will be something that maintains some kind of complexity, you know, a little bit of push and pull, something that is not quite so predictable and yet has a pattern that I can understand. So I know where to look for the meaning.
Okay. So I would actually like to play something that you know and understand the meaning of very, very well. This is you actually singing Lua Descolorida. Did I say that right? Oh, I probably did.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, Descolorida. It's a poem by Rosalia de Castro, and you were performing this with your chamber music group, Vocalective, in 2014. Is my guest Indre Viscontis singing with her chamber music group Vocalective in 2014. How long have you loved this music, Indre?
Oh, from the first time I heard this piece, I should say it's by a composer named Osvaldo Golihoff. And I actually met him when I was doing a program in Banff up in Canada in 2007, I think it was. And got to work on this piece with him first off. And, you know, the way that he explained the reason that he picked this poem, the way that he said it, the way that it really is about bending time. Because, you know, you hear the strings kind of, you know, putting down this beat, and then the singer kind of moving all around it. And it describes the emotions that a woman who is profoundly sad, I mean, the poem really is about how she not only wants to die, she wants to be completely wiped out so that there's no memory of her. And so, you know, that's that kind of emotion that comes out of this, you know, going around the beat and you know, we've all been in situations where, you know, we sort of want something, but we know that if we approach it, it's not going to be ultimately a good thing.
Right. So that is the emotion and meaning that's produced through hearing you sing this song. But what parts of the brain are being activated or are active to produce this experience that we have when we hear music that we love?
Yeah, so it depends very much on how you're listening and what you're doing. So if you're a performer, you know, your brain signature will look very different from if you're a listener, even if you're a performer listening to music. So, you know, our brains are essentially, you know, a record of our experiences. So let's say you're a listener and you're listening to this music and you're actually not finding it very moving. So then you might see parts of the auditory cortex light up. You might see parts of the brain that are trying to kind of figure out what this is all about lighting up. But you're not going to get this kind of reward system engaged. But if you find this music moving emotionally, then your brain is actually going to look a lot like the brain of the performer. We see some what we call sort of mirroring activity where, you know, you're trying to figure out what the performer is emoting. And to do that, you in your own brain mimic what it might be like if you were the performer yourself. So we see this kind of mirroring system activation. And then we also see, if it's pleasurable to you, a reward pathway light up. And that means, and in that reward pathway, what's interesting about it is that it really is still about predicting. So if you are anticipating getting pleasure from like the climax of a piece, then that part of your reward system will be active. And if it isn't active, then how much you like the piece is going to be affected. So you're not going to get that big boost of pleasure. That's why musicians really work very hard to set up tension. And, you know, some people reduce music to just, it's just tension and then release, which from the brain's perspective is pretty true. You know, you've got this part of your reward system that is called like the wanting pathway, the desire. And this is really activated, you know, during the anticipation phase before, you know, the release of tension. And the better the musician is able to do that, the sort of more activity we see in this pathway. And then when you actually get the, you know, release, you see another part of the reward pathway light up, which is the liking part.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, you know, let's take it down to an even more basic level, because you ask a question in the book about, you know, how is it that our brains turn sound into music? And you make the argument that the music doesn't even exist until our brains have made it as such. So how do we do that? How do we turn pressure waves into the experience of music?
Yeah, I mean, I don't even think sound is out there. I mean, I think sound is in our heads because we could have turned pressure waves into some other kind of stimulation. I mean, there are other animals that, you know, respond to pressure waves and have a very different experience. But for some reason, you know, we have evolved for it to be experienced as sound. And essentially that happens because the pressure waves are turned into little mechanical, movement of these hair cells in your inner ear, which translate that mechanical movement into a membrane potential change, or essentially an electrical signal. But that's not enough. That just gives you the sense that there is a pressure wave out there and that it might have certain features like, you know, a frequency or an amplitude. But the way that we actually say, hey, that's, you know, an A flat, or, you know, that's the word love, that's much higher up in the brain, where your brain now is creating templates for different sounds and matching them up and trying to figure out what this particular pattern of activation in your inner ear means. And that's why our early experiences with sound are critically important for how, you know, these regions are developed. So, you know, if you grow up in an environment where there's a lot of unwanted noise, then to survive, you need to tune it out. And in fact, kids that are exposed to a lot of unwanted noise early on can have problems later distinguishing speech sounds, for example, from other noise. They can have, you know, reading and language difficulties in school. And one way that we can help them is actually by giving them musical training. And, you know, even a few months or a year of musical training can actually change the way their brains process sound, which we can measure, and then help them read and write and speak better.
Wow.
So, you know, it really is about this interplay between how your brain is making sense of the noise, what capacity it has to turn it into meaning, and then how we use it.
Well, you know, when we come back, we'll also talk about why your teenage years are so important in shaping your musical ear and what music does to your brain. Indre Viscontis, stand by here for just a second. Indre is author of the new book, How Music Can Make You Better. She's a neuroscientist and an opera singer, and we'll head into the break with Adele. This is Hello from 2015, one of the tracks that Indre points to in her book about how music can make us feel. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and apologies to everyone out there for doing this to you, but we are talking about what music does to your brain, and we're talking about it because we're joined today by Indre Viscontis. She's authored the new book, How Music Can Make You Better. We want to hear how you respond to music and what your question is about the effect that music has on our brains and how much it means to you. And of course, this is Baby Shark by Pink Fong. Again, our apologies to everyone because it's likely going to hijack your brain and be stuck with you for the rest of the day. So Indre, you write about this. This is one of those classic earworms. James, our engineer, I'm done with this now. He's going to take it out. Thank you. Thank you, James. But Indre, what is an earworm? How does it hijack our brain so powerfully?
Yeah, that's so cruel to a mother of two small children.
I know, I'm right there with you.
So an earworm is, you know, the official scientific term for it is stuck song syndrome, or an involuntary musical imagery. And essentially, it's when our brains are playing a tune in our heads that we simply feel like we have no control over, that we can't stop it. And this generally happens with pieces that don't have a clear ending. So Baby Shark is a great example. Another example is The Lion Sleeps Tonight, or Who Let the Dogs Out, where, you know, you have these refrains that keep going and going and going, or the wheels on the bus, and there isn't like a clear end point. And the reason I make that point is because that's actually the cure for the earworm, is to actually let your brain finish the song, and then, you know, it'll think, okay, this thing is done now. But it's essentially this involuntary musical imagery that we have in our heads. Some people, if you're more attuned to music, you're also more likely to be affected by them. Mm. Women and men seem to get them about evenly, but women find them more irritating, interestingly enough.
Yes.
In general. But that's exactly what it is. It's a little part of your brain continuing the song outside of your, you know, voluntary volition.
Definitely far outside my voluntary volition. But does this tell us why, maybe this is an unrelated issue, but does this tell us why in so much modern pop music, for example, the lyric is very, very secondary. In fact, the overall structure of the song isn't as important as that hook, right? Because we have producers who get paid a lot of money to come up with 3 or 4 bars of music that form a hook that underpins an entire song. And it's why people fall in love with it from the first 5 seconds.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, music is a great mnemonic. It's really easy for our brains to remember it. And that's partly because it's multiply represented in different pathways in our brains. And, you know, it just seems to really hook us in. And, you know, the one universal feature of music across all cultures and genres is repetition, except in the one genre that explicitly avoids it, which you can call contemporary mm-hmm. classical or new music. And people find it really hard to listen to new music if they don't know what to listen for, because it doesn't have repetition. There's some great studies from Elizabeth Helmuth Margulis's lab, where she actually hacked a couple of pieces by Elliot Carter and Luciano Berio by inducing artificial repetitions into them. These are pieces that don't have repetitions. You know, and people rated them as more likable, more interesting, and even more likely to have been composed by a human being compared to the originals. You know, this is a fundamental feature, I think, of music, and it allows us to find the pattern more easily. So a song that has a great hook, you know, immediately sort of tells us where the pattern is, what should we be listening for. And interestingly, with pop music, I feel that it kind of lets us tune out in a sense. Right. We don't have to listen quite as hard. And we can just kind of let it be background music and enjoyable that way, as opposed to music where you're really working hard to understand.
Right. So that work that we need to put into understanding music, I want to talk with you more about that later. But there's something that we began to discuss before we had to take a quick break that I wanted to return to. And that is sort of the two major times of life where our brains are in a certain state that really lead to our future love of types of music. And you're talking about early exposure and infancy. And puberty is another one. So why? And does it also explain why I will forever love the worst songs from the late 80s?
Absolutely does. I'm right there with you, except for me, it's the late 90s. And, you know, the reason is because, you know, that's a time, and it's not just puberty, I would say. It's your teenage years and up into your early 20s. And this is a time period when the front of your brain is really myelinating up. So those connections are becoming more efficient and faster. I mean, there's no, it's no coincidence why teenagers sometimes make poor decisions or are more impulsive. You know, the part of their brain that, you know, ultimately comes online in your 20s is not fully functional yet. And at the same time, puberty brings these big hormonal changes that with them come emotional swings. And so you're trying to navigate these big emotional waves at the same time where you don't have, you know, your fully formed adult brain yet. And there's also this push to separate from your family and find a new tribe. That's something that, you know, is probably adaptive. It's probably was what allows us to then go out and, you know, find a partner and reproduce. So, you know, our genes like that. And so part of that process is trying to, you know, distinguish yourself. And so this whole confluence of factors make it so that music at that time period can be really influential.
Right.
And the reason it can is because music creates social bonds. It's a powerful social glue. And part of the reason that it's like that is not only because it triggers this reward pathway and motivation, and you know all of that is really salient when you're a teenager, but also because we see high levels of another hormone called oxytocin, which mm-hmm. you know some people call the love hormone, but it's really involved in attachment and creating bonds, for better or for worse. Actually, oxytocin is also high, or can make us aggressive to people who are not in our tribe. in some ways it can be the hate hormone as
wow.
well. So when we find a tribe and we listen and we are bonded through music and we have these like strong oxytocin moments, then you can see why that particular music would become, you know, something that we really have an affinity for.
An affinity for the rest of your lives, because I mean, just the other day, I don't know why, I just felt I had this need to go have a binge on Counting Crows. I just like loved them. And yeah, you were talking about the late 90s. There's also like the early and mid 90s. And so I was listening to them all day long and my kids were like, this is the worst music ever. Why are you subjecting it to us? And I was like, you have no idea how good it makes me feel. But listen, Indre, we've got some callers. We've got a lot of callers actually who want to join us. So let me welcome them in. We're talking this hour with Indre Viscontis. She's author of the new book, How Music Can Make You Better. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. And Indre is an opera singer and a neuroscientist. So let's go to Tom, who is calling from Aberdeen, South Dakota. Tom, you're on the air. What's your question?
Hello. My question, I think you've kind of touched on it, but I find myself, you know, having grown up in the Great Plains, really appreciating, you know, the American styles of music, and that can even be very broad. However, I do find a lot of times music from other countries that have different instrumentations or singing different languages can be quite grating from time to time. And I understand that much like a language, but is there a commonality to how we develop a language and how we develop our appreciation for music? And can that be impacted and changed as we go on, or are we stuck with what we got when we're raised in a small town in the middle of America?
Tom, thank you so much for your call. Indre, what's your answer for him?
Yeah, so I mean, you're on the right track in the sense that, you know, there might be some aspects of the way that we process language that might bleed into how we listen to music. Although the data really aren't that clear. So some people used to think that people that grew up in tonal languages are more likely to have perfect pitch because they sort of listen to tones and label them in a very explicit way. That is true, but it might have more to do with sort of, you know, a genetic component, but also the way that they are, you know, the way they experience music. So it turns out that perfect pitch can be trained in the right critical period in childhood. But, you know, I think that the way that we kind of understand tonality has a lot to do with the music that we are exposed to even early on. So, you know, babies born to Western parents in you know, Western cultures tend to prefer Western music early on, and they tend to shy away from things like dissonance and towards things like consonants. And so that might be because that's what their ears are attuned to. In other cultures where tonality is somewhat different, where in fact, sort of there are more dissonant tones or more leading tones, you know, so for our Western ears, that can be hard to process. Mm. But you don't have to despair. You can teach your brain simply by listening more and more and exposing yourself more and more to that kind of music, what to listen for and why it's great. And it happens almost effortlessly. These kinds of like, you know, we figure out these regularities implicitly, so outside of our conscious awareness. And so just by listening to it over and over and over again, even if you're not actively listening, eventually your brain is going to start processing that
right.
sound differently.
Well, because we'll talk more about the remarkable plasticity of the brain throughout life here. But I wanted to shift gears for a moment, Indre, because there was a story that you tell in the book, which I didn't realize, and it's very, very profound. So let's listen to a little music attached to this story. This is Raffi from 1982 and This Little Light of Mine.
This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine.
This little light of mine from 1982. Now, Indre, in the book, you said that this song helped Gabby Giffords learn how to say certain words again as she was recovering from being shot in the head. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so there's actually a very powerful video of this. She is in a therapy session, speech therapy session. So after, when she was shot, some of the damage was in her left frontal lobe, which is where your speech production areas are located. So it made it very difficult for her to talk. And you know, if you remember Gabby before the accident, she was a great orator. So this was like robbing her of one of the things that she was so good at. It was probably so dear to her. And so you watch her sort of struggle to say the word light. And so, you know, she's with the therapist and the therapist is saying, let's say light, light. And Gabby is really struggling and she can't, and she breaks down crying. I mean, it's hard for me to watch that video and not also break down crying. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, the therapist starts singing This Little Light of Mine and Gabby joins her. And she sings the song, you know, not in tune, not well, but she starts pronouncing the word light over and over and over again and let it shine. And all of a sudden she has no trouble, you know, producing that word. And the reason is that now she's using the right frontal part of her brain in order to do this, most likely. And what we see in this kind of therapy, it's called melodic intonation therapy, although this was just, you know, using singing as an example. But in melodic intonation therapy, it's expressly using melodies to sort of retrain the right hemisphere to take over some of the language functions that the left hemisphere was doing before the injury. It's very powerful.
Wow.
Yeah. And so you actually see when we can see changes in the size of the white matter tract or the connections between the part in the right hemisphere that hears or thinks about or images sound and then that produces sound.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an equivalent area in our left hemisphere that allows us to, you know, take something that we want to say and then say it. And
so
we see this kind of rewiring happening through music.
Amazing. Let's go to another quick call here. Let's go to Rick, who's calling from Newburyport, Massachusetts. Rick, you're on the air.
Hello, and thank you. Two thoughts. First, I was a little puzzled. I thought I heard at the beginning of the program that if you are involved in or interested in one genre, you tend to stick in that genre. And my experience is that I have a broad base of interest across the scope, and the first song melody that came to my mind was Adagio for Strings,
right,
which I love and moves me all the time. That's just a wonderful thing. And the other part was I seem to have a great memory for remembering a song or a tune based on the music, but for the life of me, I cannot remember all the words like some of my friends can.
Well, Rick, thank you so much for your call. And let me just say, since you mentioned Adagio for Strings, we have a recording of that here. This is Samuel Barber's Adagio, a 1976 recording performed by Leonard Bernstein and the New York Philharmonic.
Thank you.
That's Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings from 1976, conducted by Leonard Bernstein at the New York Philharmonic. Indre Viscontis, you mention Barber's Adagio multiple times in the book. What does this piece do so powerfully to us?
Yeah, Rick is not alone in feeling moved by this piece. It's actually, my friend Valerie Salimpour did a bunch of work on what kind of music induces the chills in us and what is the brain basis for this experience. And she found in her studies that this was the most common piece that gives people the chills. And there's the reason for it might have to do with the fact that we all know where the orchestra wants to go, right? Mm-hmm. We hear it. We so desperately want it to get there. And we've all experienced, you know, this kind of desire to go somewhere and all the things on our journey that keep us from getting there. And so it's this long meandering buildup of tension that eventually finally gets released. And so I think that it's very easy for our brains to sort of predict where it's going, but also be pleasantly surprised when it doesn't get there yet. And so that's the meaning that we hear.
Well, apparently we hear that meaning even in different versions of Adagio for Strings, because right now you're hearing a techno version by Tiesto. This is from 2004 off the album Just Be. So we're going to head into the break with that. Indre Viscontis is author of the new book, How Music Can Make You Better. And we're talking about what music does inside our brains and the effects it has on us, and as her book says, how it can make us better. We'll be right back. We want to hear from you. This is the techno version of Adagio for Strings. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Indre Viscontis. She's a professor of sciences and humanities at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music and an adjunct professor of psychology at the University of San Francisco. She's a neuroscientist and an opera singer and author of the new book, How Music Can Make You Better. And what we're listening to right now is Katie Moss Catwalk, a 2016 piece from Music for Cats Album 1 by David Tithe. Now, we've been talking about music in the human brain here, Indre, but this is a song for cats, literally for cats. I mean, how do animals respond differently to music than we humans do?
Yeah, I'm so glad you were able to find this piece. So David Tithe has done some really interesting work in terms of trying to figure out what it sounds like to be a cat, right? Like, if you're a cat, what do you actually hear? Because, you know, the spectral envelope that they can process is different from ours, right? And so then he's tried to create a music that essentially taps into the kind of soundscape that the cats would prefer. And he does this for a bunch of different species. And I think it's a really interesting, because we might not find it that appealing, but, you know, cats really do find it interesting. And, you know, it's unclear whether we have the same kind of underlying mechanisms by why music is moving to us versus to the cat, in terms of, like, does the cat actually find it socially bonding?
Right.
Does it find meaning? Is it sort of learning more about itself?
Or are they seeking similar types of patterns or different types of patterns that the music may evoke?
Yeah, so we don't know 100% because we can't ask the cat, but we can certainly see that the cat would prefer to listen to this kind of soundscape rather than something that we find really appealing. And, you know, some of the work I find really interesting also comes from monkeys. So, you know, they played different music for monkeys, and monkeys unfortunately did not like Barber's Adagio for Strings as much as they liked Metallica. Yeah, and maybe it's something to do with, like, you know, their vocalizations, and maybe they hear some kind of emotional expression in the Metallica that they can understand, but the Strings, not so much.
Monkeys and Metallica. You see, every day you learn something new and profound about our natural world. Okay, so let's go back to our phones. Let's go to Willa, who's calling from Burlington, Vermont. Willa, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. What a great subject. I have so many questions, but I'm phoning because I have a great example of how deeply music goes into us, and I hope none of my friends are listening because I've told this story 1,000 times. But when my mother was dying and I had rigged up in her room a sound system with all, you know, swing music and the music from her era, Frank Sinatra, blah, and had it just on random play, and she'd just be lying in bed and hadn't spoken for days, and just lying there and lying there, and all of a sudden she'd perk up and say, "I get no kick from champagne, mere alcohol doesn't," and then she'd sink back down onto her pillow.
Wow.
But she was just singing along with whatever was playing. It was just fascinating. I loved it. And
Willa, actually, thank you so much for your call, because Indre, in your book, I mean, Willa's mother was perhaps in her last days or months when this was happening, but you also write about how for Alzheimer's patients or dementia patients, music has forms a powerful connection that, as Willa was saying, can pull them out of their dementia, at least temporarily.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a great gift that she could give her mother, that sense of, you know, final connection to something. Because one of the things that's very isolating when you have dementia is that you feel, first of all, you don't have control over your environment anymore. You're not connected to other people. And, you know, imagine how, I mean, social ostracism, you know, it activates the pain, the physical pain regions in our brain. It's you know, it's very hard for us to handle. And so music is one way in which you can still find connection with a person, you know, whose ability to speak using language has really deteriorated. Because it's, you know, still multiply represented in the brain, it has these deep connections. And in the case of patients with Alzheimer's disease, we actually see that the parts of the brain that process familiar music remain intact, even through the late stages. So it's a way for you as a caregiver, as a person who loves someone, to feel connected to the person who is suffering from the disease, but also for that person to regain a sense of connection with others. And that's incredibly powerful. So, yeah, I think that that's why music is so great in those kinds of circumstances. Now, you know, we think that we need to always present music from the era that you know, as we talked about earlier, you know, we have this period in our late teens, early 20s. And even when we remember memories, we call it the reminiscence bump. We tend to kind of feed back into that area of our lives because it was so meaningful and formative. But that doesn't necessarily have to be true. There's some nice evidence now, too, that even just a live performance of any kind of even new music, as long as it's accessible enough, so it's not, you know, it's easy for the person to kind of pick up the pattern, et cetera. You know, you can, even if you don't have your language facility anymore, you can still get what someone is saying from their tone of voice. You know, like even babies, before they're able to speak, they can tell whether you're happy or sad or angry. And we can hear that. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I love Adele, is because you can hear in her voice how she's feeling, and that goes beyond the words that she's saying.
Yeah.
And so the same is true for a person, you know, who's suffering from dementia. They can sort of respond to those emotional qualities, and that can help them feel connected again.
Mm. Well, let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Jennifer, who's calling from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Jennifer, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I was going to say, I always think about the connection between central nervous system and peripheral, the effect you get when you hear something you haven't heard in a long time. When I was actually 16 years old, I was with a friend in the hospital holding his hand, and he loved Queen. So we were listening to Bohemian Rhapsody over and over again, and I realized he was going to die. Like, any second, I knew he was going to die, and I just started sweating. My heart started beating, and he died, and I waited until the song was over and got the nurse. And then a few weeks ago, my oldest son said, oh, I want to go see this movie about Freddie Mercury. I'm like, oh, sure, well, no problem. We're in the theater, and I'm just, like, started sweating, and I felt sick, and I started to cry and left. And he's like, what is wrong with you, Mom? And I'm like, I still feel like I did that moment my friend died.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I just hadn't expected to be that physically intense.
Right. Jennifer, thank you for your call. Indre, does this have to do with what you were telling us a little early in the hour about the sort of there are endocrine system reactions as well? You were talking about oxytocin being released or a key factor in how we process or hear music.
Yes, but I think this is also, as she mentioned, part of the autonomic nervous system, branch of the peripheral nervous system, where, you know, essentially your brain is somehow perceiving a kind of threat, and you're having this kind of fight or flight reaction. And luckily, we're human. We have a prefrontal cortex that can mitigate how we respond to that. So we don't go into the full fight or flight. But sort of what she's sort of describing is this, you know, this sympathetic nervous system activation. And, you know, that's a powerful modulator of memory. You know, the things that we remember best are often times when we were most afraid, you know, and that's because, you know, there's part of our brain, the limbic system and the amygdala in particular, that monitors what's going on in our experiences. And when there is an experience that triggers this system, we say, aha, we better remember this, because this is something that might be critical for our survival. And because music can actually activate fight or flight, and we don't fully understand exactly why, but the chills might, there might be something in there, because that piloerection or the goosebumps is part of that system. It might be that, you know, the system is activated, but we kind of we see that the environment is non-threatening, and so maybe that's why it's kind of cathartic or comforting. But we certainly know that there's some interplay between these systems, and that's one of the reasons why music is such a powerful mnemonic.
So there's so much ground that we could cover under this big umbrella of music and the brain. So let me just sort of take us in a couple little different directions now. Does music have to possess a certain human imperfection for it to work on us? Because, you know, technically speaking, you can write music as a series of, it is, notes on a page that ostensibly in this day and age, you know, a computer could generate. But is there something between the notes on the page and how we absorb it that requires a certain imperfection for us to feel it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, a lot of us, especially classically trained musicians, we strive so hard to create a perfect performance. But in fact, a perfect performance is one that contains imperfections, whether they're deliberate or not. If you think about the people who first created like artificial drum beats, when they made them too perfect, they just didn't sound natural. They didn't sound human. And so they had to start putting in these kind of probabilities and irregularities into the drum beat for people to say, oh yeah, that sounds like a real drummer. And, you know, the same is true for so many different aspects of our lives, but certainly in music, if it's too perfect a performance, we tend to think of it as non-human, as mechanical. But if it has some, you know, imperfections, then we're more likely to say, oh yeah, that's human. You know, and that's a reflection of us as flawed beings.
Okay. So then on the in another realm of music and the brain, there is this persistent thought amongst new parents that if you make your kid listen to Mozart, that you're going to grow bigger brain cells in your children. Is there any truth to that? Is listening enough, or do we have to play it? Do we have to engage with music to get the great benefits that music can give to the brain?
Well, listening to Mozart seems to be enough if you're a rat.
If you're a rat, okay.
Seem to do better at mazes after listening to Mozart. Human beings only for about 15 minutes. And that seems to be more a function of just general arousal. So, you know, if you're listening in silence and then asked to do a bunch of IQ tests, you're probably a little more bored than if you got to listen to Mozart and then be, you know, asked to do the same IQ test. So the original Mozart effect seems to be explained by general arousal. Because you can get the same benefits from, say, reading a chapter out of a Stephen King novel or listening to pop music like Blur. But what we do see in terms of long-term changes in the brain and in terms of what we call the Holy Grail or far transfer, which is, you know, can learning music or some other kind of task actually make you smarter in ways that are quite different from the task at hand? And that we see, it's a little bit controversial because there's some confounding variables like socioeconomic status for kids that are able to persist in music lessons. But it seems like you need at least 3 years of instrumental or individual music lessons to show kind of real measurable benefits on IQ tests.
Right.
So, you know, I think there is this dose response curve. So the more time you spend learning an instrument or developing your voice, the more likely it is to transfer over into other areas of your life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there are many reasons why music training and education is particularly effective. For one, it's, you know, hits this motivation reward system. So it's easier to stick to than, say, you know, doing some other kind of activity that maybe isn't quite as rewarding.
Yeah.
It has a social nature to it. So, for example, if you have a band at a middle school or a high school, kids are more likely to come to school. So it actually reduces
with the music
absenteeism.
Class. Oh, interesting. I just have to jump in here for 1 second and say, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Let's see if we can sneak one more call in here, okay? Let's go to Bill, who's calling from Northborough, Massachusetts. Bill, you're on the air.
Meghna, you are a lady after my own heart. You started off the hour by playing The Lark Ascending.
Vaughan Williams,
Oh, God, yes. That has to be the perfect composition. I mean, it is absolutely flawless, especially in that particular composition when you're listening to the violinist.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's only 14 and a half minutes long, but it is unbelievable. I defy anyone to listen to that and not be brought close to tears. You have to have no soul in order not to appreciate that music. The other thing I wanted to bring up, Robert Frost had written something about poetry, but I'm going to substitute music for poem. And he said, the right listener of good music can tell the moment it strikes him that he has taken an immortal wound, that he will never get over it. That is to say, permanence in good music, as in love, is perceived instantly.
Wow.
And I think that encapsulates it all. One other point, by the way, I think it's possible to enjoy Beethoven or Ralph Vaughan Williams and also appreciate the Jefferson Airplane or Fleetwood Mac or even the Beatles. Flawless music is flawless music, regardless of the genre.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for your call, and thank you for being a fellow Vaughan Williams fan, because even just you mentioning the name of the song, I can hear it in my head again. Thank you so much. Indre, Bill got us back to where we started in terms of you made that point that there's no such thing as great music, right? That it's very subjective, but it's great to us. But you also said something later in the conversation that I want to spend the last minute and a half our time together on. You said that sometimes people in this day and age, we don't have to work so hard anymore to perhaps appreciate music in the way that we did in the past. I don't know if I'm saying this right, but my question for you is, do you think more people ought to try and work harder to appreciate the music they already love, even, or outside the genres they love? More music education? It sounds like there's something that you want us to do as humans in engaging in music.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest tragedy is that we don't participate in music making as much anymore. I mean, I think that because we have access to all these great recordings, we think, well, why should I, you know, put my meager, performance of a great piece out there? And I would argue the reason is that music, I think, evolved because we are social. It evolved as participatory, and we're not getting all of the benefits if we're just sitting on the sidelines and listening. You know, you don't have to, you know, be perfect and show the greatest performance, but you can get a lot out of just trying to make music. In fact, right. I just want to leave you with this one thought. You know, in some prisons, the most coveted privilege is the ability to make music. You know, it's not cell phones. It's not, you know, these other things. It's making music. So wow. I think it's really powerful.
Well, Indre Viscontis, her new book is How Music Can Make You Better. We have a link to it at onpointradio.org. Indre, this has been an absolutely joyful hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we're going to go out today with The Marriage of Figaro by Mozart, of course. It's one of Indre's favorite that she writes about in the book. This is The Marriage of Figaro performed by the London Philharmonic Orchestra. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.